This is Josephine Decker. I directed Butter on the Left and Thou Wast Mild and Lovely. You're listening to Film Wax Radio.
This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Hello, everybody. This is Adam Shartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio. You're listening to episode number 256, if you can believe it, episode number 256 of the podcast. This episode is sponsored by RealWorks. It's a terrific organization. It's located in Brooklyn. It's a terrific organization located in Brooklyn, New York. They teach high schoolers to become documentary filmmakers. They also have a mentoring program. It's just fantastic. If you have any interest, go to realworks.org and get in touch with this terrific organization. They also happen to have a Friday night film series. I think it's called the Friday Night Film Series, ironically. And this coming Friday, November 21st, they're going to have a screening of a documentary called A Will for the Woods. Now, for my regular listeners, if that sounds somewhat familiar, well, it's because on episode number 228, I had on 50%, half of the filmmaking team of that documentary, A Will for the Woods, which is about green burials. So, if you recall, Amy Brown and Jeremy Kaplan came on and they talked about making the movie, about the subject of the film, and much, much more. But I, all of a sudden, because of the screening and because RealWorks is sponsoring this episode, I had an opportunity to bring on the other two filmmakers, the other 50%. And so I very enthusiastically said, yes, let's do this to these two guys. Their names are Tony Hale and Brian Wilson, and they'll be coming on in a little bit. But I did want to say that I am going to be there at the screening. I'm looking forward to it. They do a great job. It is curated by my friend Ralph Scott, who himself is a filmmaker. And so I'm just recommending that. Or if you know a high schooler who could benefit from this organization, check them out. Come on out. Meet everybody this Friday. It's a free screening. And I believe at least Tony and Brian will be there. I am also thinking Jeremy Kaplan will also be at the screening. Okay, so episode number 256 of the podcast. That's this episode. It's a documentary-oriented episode. And the first guest who's coming up in just a moment is Lacey Schwartz. This conversation occurred at the Woodstock Film Festival about a month ago. And I was reading the New York Times over the summer, and there was an article about her film, which is called Little White Lie. And basically, as you're going to find out, she had been brought up by two white Jewish parents in Woodstock, but she looked very different. Her complexion looked different. Her hair looked different. You know, I mean, something wasn't right, you know, and it was always explained away in some strange kind of rationale, but she knew something just wasn't right. And as an adult, she finally confronted her family and she found out the truth about her identity and her background and her history. And it's an amazing story and it's in a great film. And again, it's called Little White Lie. And guess what? It's having its theatrical premiere here in New York, playing the week of the November 21st at the AMC Empire 25 on 42nd Street. It will then be in Los Angeles at the Lemmy Music Hall in Beverly Hills. That's starting November 28th. Then it will be in San Francisco the week of December 5th at the AMC Metreon. And then also at in Washington, D.C. at the AMC Shirlington. I guess that's technically in Alexandria, Virginia. And then again in L.A. at the AMC Burbank 8, also on the week of December 5th. So it's having quite a good run. It will then, a little later on, have its broadcast premiere on PBS. So we will keep you abreast about all that. But we'll have Lacey on in just a moment. And then we're going to have on Brian Wilson and Tony Hale, from the other two filmmakers of the four who made A Will for the Woods, which is a documentary about green burials. So now Tony Hale is not the actor who's on Arrested Development, nor is Brian Wilson the lead singer and songwriter for the Beach Boys. This is a different pair of guys, okay? But I did meet with them, and this conversation was a lot of fun. So I look forward to you listening to that in just a few minutes. Last up is a conversation I had with a monk. He's the subject of a new documentary called Monk with a Camera. And his name is Nicky Vreeland. And now if that sounds familiar, it's because his mother is Diana Vreeland, who is, of course, the fashion writer and consultant. Well, Diana, of course, was very wealthy, and she had one of her sons is named Nicky Vreeland, and he was brought up with great amount of money and privilege, but turned away from all that to become a monk. It's an incredible story. He's a fully ordained Tibetan Buddhist monk. So there you go. But he's also a photographer. How do these two worlds converge together? That's for you to find out. Go see Monk with a Camera. I hope your interest is piqued, because you'll find out in just a few minutes also. So let's go first right now into my conversation with the filmmaker, Lacey Schwartz.
I come from a long line of New York Jews. I grew up in a world with synagogue, Hebrew school, bar mitzvahs. So it never occurred to me that I was passing. I wasn't pretending to be something I wasn't. I actually grew up believing I was white.
Show us how you can stand on your side. Oh, that's terrific. How do you do that?
We lived almost picture-perfect kind of life for a while. So when Lacey decided she was going to tell the story, I was a little nervous about it.
If you look too closely at it, it didn't make any sense. So we found ways to see what we wanted to believe.
I always looked at you like you looked black. To me, you're just like a Jewish kid who, I don't know.
White people will think anything. Crazy things. I'll know white people for a long time.
Today's the day. We did it.
It really is the power of denial. How the hell did anybody sort of not acknowledge this?
It just seems like the 600-pound gorilla in the room to kind of just refuse to see it.
The name of your film, Lacey, is called Little White Lie. It's a nice play on words.
Thank you.
Do you want to describe it, or shall I describe it? What do you think?
You can describe it.
Me?
Yeah.
Okay. You grew up in a nice Jewish home, right, here in Woodstock, New York, right?
Yes.
In a nice middle-class Jewish home. I guess the thing that was always there, not spoken about, but that always was like there, was that you looked different. Your hair was different. Your complexion was somewhat different. And so, but nobody kind of talked about it, right? So
right.
It was always, and then finally this film is kind of about when you're achieving adulthood and forging your own relationships and starting your own family. This is about you getting, opening up that Pandora's box, right? And finally having very kind of the blunt conversations that need to happen with your parents and about where, you know, why do you look different and where are you, you know, what's the real story?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a safe way to put it?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's perfect.
And also, as this another thread is, I guess, is your, specifically when, you know, you were having finally some of the conversation, you found out the truth about your biological father, who's a friend of the family, say, or of your mom's anyway. And they had an affair. It's not a spoiler, right?
Yep, that's exactly it.
And you're going to college, your identity, and how you sort of... You know, it's funny, because a lot of people... I've spoken to a few people in the past, and they found out they were Jewish. They had Jewish ancestors. And if they clicked for them, they said, that makes sense. I wonder if you had that experience. I mean, what that... Of course you did, but, like, what that experience was for you when you found out, okay, my dad's black. This is not some great-grandfather from, you know... wherever, from Eastern Europe or what have you. They were trying to explain it away that way.
So it absolutely clicked for me, and I think really in two ways. One was because outside of whether or not I connected to the black community, mm-hmm. I really felt this idea of not really knowing where I came from or why I looked the way I did. So there was always a confusion about that, a question mark, this unsettling feeling. So finding out about my biological father really helped with that. Uh-huh. But I think even beyond that, I did start to then develop a relationship and a connection to the Black community. Mm-hmm. And, you know, listen, I think it, part and parcel, I don't know if that would have happened in every Black community. You know, I don't think that it's such a...
There isn't just one?
There, exactly. Oh, like there is. But when I was at, you know, this university experience that yes. I was in, being part of the Black community, specifically at Georgetown, was a place where I felt like the totality of who I was mm-hmm. was welcomed and accepted.
Right.
And that was, you know, for me, especially growing up in an environment where I felt like it was about uniformity. It was about kind of being one thing. Being in this Black community at a institution of higher education mm-hmm. was actually about the diversity of that.
Right.
It wasn't about this kind of singular thing of what being Black was, but it was still nonetheless about being a part of something.
Right. And also that they're interested in that, the conversation around identity at that age. And this is the time where you're supposed to explore that, right? As you're finding your own.
I think you're absolutely right. I came from a place where we weren't talking about my identity, even though it was so obvious, and I went into a space where people were very willing to talk about it and deal with it, and that was welcoming to me.
So anyway, I guess I could kind of basically explained it. Your mother was afraid. It came off kind of very afraid. She was like, maybe you're rejecting her or judging her for what she did. Right? She was very ashamed of her affair on some level.
You know, I think on one hand, my mother was very much doing what she wanted to do. On the other hand, she was also worried about maintaining the status quo and protecting other people. And I don't think it was about protecting me. I think it was also about, I mean, ironically, about protecting my father as well. And also just maintaining her situation. You know, it was a little bit of like a cake and eat it too, right? Where you know, even though she obviously did, I think, in the end, hurt my father, it wasn't her intention. And she was kind of trying to do what she wanted to do, but at the same time trying to protect him. So she was trying to kind of keep a lot of things in the air at one time as opposed to just accepting the reality.
Yeah. I think you're referring to the fact a lot of people have affairs and they're able to rationalize not divulging it because they know that the only thing more painful than the affair is the partner to find out about it. So maybe just... don't do it again. Don't talk about it. In this case, there's a child involved. She actually gave birth, which is such a weird phenomenon, how you can be in such a state of denial, referring to your mom at the time, which is a normal place to be in your mind, I guess, but that she would give birth knowing that it was, I think she knew, right, that Rodney was the...
You know, I mean...
Maybe she didn't. Maybe denial is strong.
I think denial is a huge theme of the film, and I think everybody had their own timeline of their denial. And I think even my mother was in denial to a certain degree.
Yeah.
And so I don't think that literally she was having this moment that when I was born, she was thinking, oh, this is not his child. I think she was able to, in those moments, convince herself. Now, do I think her denial ended earlier than others? Because obviously she had more information than anybody else did. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And your father really comes off as a very... interesting, not easy, kind of prickly guy in the context of this story. I mean, I don't know what he's like outside of that, but very compelling in with that, because it's like, you know, look at all these different sides of the story and terribly human. I mean, you know, everybody wants that dad at that dad moment and put his arms around you and say, you know, I accept you for who you are this, and but you will always be my daughter. That moment doesn't, you know, it doesn't always happen quite like that.
Yeah.
Forgiveness is love and all these things are complicated, right? By a lot of pain and other things that are in, you know, a life that's being lived.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this movie is very much about the fact that life is how it really is and not just how you want it to be, but that nonetheless you still need to be able to figure out a way to move forward in a positive way and move past mm-hmm. those issues. It really is about kind of the power of telling the truth and the power of process and acceptance. Yeah.
It's terribly difficult. Acceptance is
totally.
Yeah. So it's called Little White Lie. It's a documentary. And I'm wondering, like, at what point you decided to make a film about it and kind of take it to a very different level, this very personal story. And also in a result of that being that, you know, your mom's personal life and Rodney's family, who are here to also have to, you know, who are part of the story, and your dad, rather, describe that decision and their, you know, I don't know, their buy-in or their what they thought of the film.
Yeah. So for me, the decision to make the film really came in a certain moment where I was still living in what I consider to be the racial closet. Mm-hmm. I knew the truth of, I had had the conversation with my mother. I knew the truth about my biological father and about being black, biracial. Mm-hmm. But I hadn't talked to the rest of my family, including my father, about that truth. And so I was very much kind of living out in my world, mm-hmm. openly identifying as being black and biracial, but then coming home and not acknowledging that and not talking about it. And at that moment, I was sort of really...
It is like a gay...
Yeah.
That hasn't come out to their family yet, right? But you're coming out to your subculture. It's similar.
Totally. I mean, I look at it a lot. What I realized when I started thinking about the film and what I wanted to talk about was I wanted to talk about the issues of dual identity. And I think that those identities can be very many things. And a lot of times we look at society and we think, oh, how is society being accepted? How is society integrating? But a lot of times internally, we're actually struggling to integrate our own identities. As you were saying, when somebody's in like kind of coming out of the closet, when you're using that term in terms of sexuality, it is sometimes about them. It's very often about them being afraid about being accepted, but sometimes they're struggling with that internally as well, to accept their own identity. And I think that that was what was happening for me. And so I really wanted to do a film about dual identity. And in particular, I was really fascinated by this idea of black Jews in America, because I was struggling to accept my own identity as being both black and Jewish. You know, I was... At that time, I had a black identity and a Jewish identity. That Jewish identity was connected to being white. And so how do I integrate those two identities in one? And I was really fascinated about doing a film that explored those issues. And I thought, that's a great topic, but what's the story? And when I started looking into other stories that I could do it in, I realized that, again, I was still struggling with my own story. So I had to actually deal with my own issues before I could talk about other people's issues. And I realized that by being willing to film my process, it would also be really powerful in terms of talking about the power of process and showing that I was willing to do what I thought other people should be willing to do as well, which is have honest and open conversations about their family secrets in order to move forward with their lives without being held back.
It's liberating.
Absolutely.
And cathartic, I suppose. It should be, hopefully.
It's super difficult. You know, it's not always amazing. But in the end, coming out the other side is absolutely liberating.
When it came time to apply to college, I had to check a box.
The only box I had ever known was white, so I just didn't check anything. And based off a photograph, I was admitted to college as a black student. And I was afraid of not being a part of the world that I had grown up in anymore.
If I could have done my life differently, there were a lot of things I would have done differently, but in the end, not really.
You know, the fact is, like, whatever happened with you and Daddy and that inability to talk about things, that is what I carry on. Nobody talked about everything because it was all secrets.
Have you read Rebecca Walker's book?
I have, yeah.
Yeah. I remember when that came out. I was forging a relationship of my own at the time with an African American woman. So we're starting a family, I guess. So it was interesting timing. And then we did have a child. And interesting, you know, the first, I guess his complexion is like yours, maybe lighter even. And at first, he, you know, as a toddler, a little older than a toddler, dad was identifying as white. And that was, you know, obviously very painful for his mother, even though he came out of that relatively quickly. I mean, I don't know if I haven't even asked him recently what he thinks he is, but it's interesting and a complex thing. And he's being raised Christian, light, you know, and with some, you know, with a certain splash of gooey tonic or seltzer or whatever. But I guess my point is, not just inserting myself into your story, but that even when it is out in the open, obviously, and there aren't secrets per se, it is still very complex. And the story is I think our parents' generations, and my parents are probably just a little older than yours, I'm guessing, maybe not. I don't know, my parents are in the late 70s?
Late 60s.
Yeah, so obviously it makes sense, a generation older. But they're interesting how a very progressive liberal background still doesn't give you a hand up in race, you know, not until you're dealing with it head on do you know what really it is to
absolutely
have to really speak the language of somebody very who comes from a very different cultural background than you do when you're really in it.
Right. And I think, you know, for you, you know, saying like about your story as well, I mean, for me, doing this film was really about, it wasn't just about my story. It was about the fact that I think these ideas of family secrets, of denial, of dual identity, of how do you learn to tell the truth, are things that affect many, many people. And so I felt like by sharing, like really, obviously, people are going to see this film and they're going to learn about me and they're going to think about my story. But really, what I want them to come out of is thinking about their own story. And we're doing actually an interactive project where we're asking other people to share their kind of quote unquote little white lies.
Family secrets.
Exactly.
So it could be being coming out of the closet about any number of things, whether it's gay or the biological, you know, secrets in your family. I guess you could say whatever it is.
Right, and it's about the power of sharing them, the power of actually having a space to talk about them. So right now we're just asking people to share them. It's part of our like post screening interactive
experience. Oh, so they can go on to the
website
and just send in their submit their story.
Yeah. So if you go to stories.littlewhitelie.thefilm.com, you can see the stories that we've had shared, and you'll see
how many are there.
So far, we have at least 60.
Oh, that's great!
Yeah, of other people who like kind of share their little white lies as well.
They stand out in your mind?
No, not all the time. I mean, they're intense. You know, they're intense, yeah. And so now we're working on partnering with a bunch of different organizations and to really figure out how to create spaces for people to further those conversations and to work through it as well.
Might make for also an interesting anthology of stories. You know?
Yeah, exactly. We're really looking to do a whole kind of multimedia experience of it, like sharing other stories in short form and what we could do with them.
And the you're from Woodstock, and that's where we are right now as we speak. You are been based in Brooklyn,
mm-hmm.
but you're moving.
Yes,
you're
I
moving
am.
Up back up here. What's the where? Are you
no,
moving?
I'm moving to Montclair, New Jersey.
Oh, Montclair. That's right. Right. Okay. So very close.
Yeah.
Very close.
Because we're going to be doing a limited theatrical release in New York. Well, in four cities, New York, L.A., San Francisco, and D.C., starting in the end of November.
And when?
We're going to be in New York the week of November 21st.
Okay, Thanksgiving week.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then you are then having a broadcast.
Yes, on Independent Lens on PBS in March 30th.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So we can maybe replay this again in March. We'll post the show in November.
Yeah, that'd be great.
In time with the theatrical, and then, you know.
Perfect.
We can re-promote in March for the broadcast. But that's great. So a lot of people will have an opportunity to see Little White Lie, right? Because it's going to have broadcast. That's always a nice thing. Are you have an idea for a new film or something to work on?
So I have a production company. It's actually a nonprofit production company called Truth Aid. We have another film that is circulating in festivals right now, and we're going to do a theatrical release.
What's that?
It's a fiction film called Defret. Defret, D-I-F-R-E-T. D-I-F-R-E-T. It's an Ethiopian film.
Oh, okay.
And that film premiered at Sundance, so we're circulating at festivals. We're actually showing at BFI this weekend in the London Festival. And that's going to be in theaters as well. And we have another project we're working on just with my producing partner and I, with an amazing director her name is Yoruba Richin.
Mm-hmm.
We're optioning a book called How It Feels to Be Free, and it's about looking at female African-American performers and how they, during the Civil Rights Movement, and how they were activists both on and off the stage and screen.
How they what?
Were activists.
Oh, activists. On screen and off screen.
Yeah, during the Civil Rights Movement.
Uh-huh. They sound like great projects.
Thank you.
Yeah, good. Well, let's hope then that this is the beginning of a series of conversations we can have.
That'd be amazing. I'd
love to. And you weren't, since you were so, and you were very collaborative in the conversation. Which was
sounds good.
Little White Lie, directed by Lacey Schwartz, November 21st, right? In New York, L.A., D.C., and fourth city, Chicago?
San Francisco.
San Francisco, excuse me. San Francisco. Sorry, folks in the Midwest. you'll have to wait for Independent Lens in March. But so nice talking.
Thank you. So there you go. If you're not in any of those major cities in New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Washington, where I mentioned that they were going to have theatrical screenings, don't worry. Don't worry, because Little White Lie will be broadcast on PBS on their series Independent Lens very soon, as we talked about. Coming up now is a conversation again with A Wolf for the Woods filmmakers Brian Wilson and Tony Hale. Again, if you go to realworks.org, you can find out all about RealWorks and this Friday night film series they're hosting, and it's free. If you live anywhere nearby, I urge you to go come out to the screening. Again, it's this Friday at 7 o'clock, and please do come out. Tony will be there, Brian will be there, I'll be there, and I believe Jeremy Kaplan will be there as well. It's a great documentary, and it always creates a great conversation afterwards. They've had a remarkable festival run. And now that you can get one, you can get a great little intimate screening right now. And then it's going to be coming out on DVD and digitally later on. I think in January, we'll keep you abreast about that. But here now, my conversation with Tony Hale and Brian Wilson.
Clark found a cemetery that owns woods that they were going to clear the woods to make another lawn, but they decided to keep the woods, and now it's their green burial woods.
Oh, really?
We saved a tract of forest by doing that.
So now that will always stay forest.
I'm Clark. I'm a psychiatrist, and I was diagnosed with lymphoma 7 years ago. That led to an increased awareness about the importance of the environment in general. Although I'm trying to overcome it, the reality is that a burial is a very likely outcome. I'd like to use whatever time I have left to help set a pattern in our community of going back to really traditional and natural ways of handling our dead.
Welcome, Brian Wilson and Tony Hale. You're Tony.
Yes.
You're Brian.
Yeah.
I'm pointing to people on the podcast. It's a good start. and so what I'll do occasionally maybe is I'll identify who's talking. Just I'll slip it in a little bit because you got the three men. We're all very masculine and have baritone voices.
So true.
So it might be difficult for listeners to differentiate unless you choose to become a generic entity. Only in terms of how you talk about the film, not in other parts of your life.
A Will for the Woods speaking.
Yes.
Will for the Woods speaking.
50% of the filmmaking team. It's funny because you don't come across too many films made by four co-directors. That was one thing. The second bit of coincidence is that it's not a coincidence, but a coincidental thing is that no, we didn't smoke anything before this interview. We just are giggling now. But was that I did a segment already on my podcast on this film only a few months ago with the other 50% of the filmmaking team, and this sort of happened. But I like that. So I did talk to Amy Brown and Jeremy Kaplan, who I don't like at all. So this is really nice.
Oh, that's been really hitting it off, huh? That's cool.
No, no, I love them both. And I'm sorry, I know Amy went back to Australia, right?
Yeah.
So, Brian.
She's moved back home to Australia now.
Yeah, and I was invited to her going away party bash.
Oh.
But it was on a weekend that I had my son, so I just...
Oh,
I just,
we missed you. It was a really one for the history books.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, probably in part due to my absence then, because I would have just brought everything down. But and I worked at DocNYC last year where I think you guys had your official New York premiere, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. So I remember ducking in, and I think I saw you all doing your Q&A, and the room was packed like crazy, and I think everybody you ever met was there.
It was one of our best audiences. Yeah, we filled the big theater at IFC. It was very exciting.
It was an amazing time for us to just be able to bring the film home after playing for, I guess it was about 6 months in other cities where we premiered it in Durham, where the film takes place. But yeah, pretty great to bring it to New York.
A Will for the Woods is about green burial. Mm-hmm. And it takes place in
Durham, North Carolina, mostly. But it follows the movement a bit around the country.
Okay. And for the primary character in the film is Clark Long, who is has lymphoma and is dying of this cancer, and decides that he is going to have a green burial and give back to the earth in that way. And it's a very cathartic and beautiful passage out of this life, you know, I think. And it comes across great in the film. And yeah. And so the other bit that was, and it's already, so it's out, and you guys are already working on the DVD release, which is a nice connection to this episode, as well as that you're having a screening coming up at RealWorks here in Park Slope on Friday, November 21st.
Yeah, the DVD and online in the U.S. will be available in January.
Okay.
We're working with First Run Features on that release, and obviously we're totally excited about that.
Is the packaging green?
It is, actually. Yeah, it's paper packaging, and I think it's soy ink, and that's what they do for all their films, I believe.
What's the name of the district?
First Run Features.
Oh, First Run. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know those guys. Sure, they put out lots of great films.
Mm. Yeah, we're really excited to be working with them.
It's a good partnership there.
And we're continuing to do screenings all over the place. We just got back from a return to Durham and for Day of the Dead weekend, and also Dallas and Santa Fe, where we had really wonderful screenings.
Okay, and that's Brian speaking. Hi, Tony.
Hey. And last time Amy and Jeremy spoke to you, it was the first theatrical screening in New York.
Yes.
And so it's been a couple months of that. And now it's great to bring it back to RealWorks, and we really love what RealWorks does. And I volunteered here before and worked with
mentoring.
Specifically for editing. I know they have the full-on mentoring where you do filmmakers will see a project with a kid through the whole project. And I came in just for a little bit of editing mentoring, which was really wonderful. And so it's great to work with them on anything.
I've been to several of their screenings of the students' films, and it's always really wonderful, inspiring. I mean, they're young kids, but they're making really beautiful work.
Yeah, you can see the voices and the talent coming out of these kids, you know, regardless of how crude as any, you know, work by someone undeveloped would be. But you see all the talent that is there, and it may be somewhat dormant, but is there.
Exactly, yeah. A couple projects that I've seen here really actually remain with me, even several years later.
Wow.
I've been struck by how strong the voices are. They have very strong messages and clear messages and moods that are evoked, and yeah, really impressed with their raw talent.
Well, it's maybe a good point to say in the talk that if you're a filmmaker and you're a documentary filmmaker primarily, but I think you could be just a filmmaker and mentor here, but they probably, since RealWorks, they tend to rely more on doing documentaries, right?
Yeah.
With some exceptions, I think. But anyway, so if you're a filmmaker and you're listening and you have time and you are in the New York area, you might want to consider becoming a mentor and contacting RealWorks, right? You can go to their website probably and get all the details you need to get about RealWorks, RealWorks.org, and consider mentoring, because I guess
we recommend it.
Tony, you found it very gratifying.
Yeah. I mean, I've done tutoring before in the past, but it was really great to have the infrastructure, and the kids are all here, very focused, you know, they know they're part of a special group. The classes are small, and so they're all very focused.
Do you find you can actually learn about, I don't know, anything? Do you learn from that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think you always learn from teaching and just trying to help some. I mean, as an editor, you're often doing that with directors, trying to help express a voice that is part yours and part theirs, and doing that with a student who just is coming at it with their own perspective, helping them figure out how to express what they are doing filmically, cinematically. Mm-hmm. You always learn, I think, from teaching.
So, Tony, you already said that you're an editor, mm-hmm. and that you're one of your at least primary roles on A Will for the Woods has been editing.
Right.
And how does that break down in terms of all your roles in this? Because there are four of you.
Yeah. So at first we thought it was this super weird thing, how many films have four co-directors? And then we're like, well, bands do it all the time. We're just like a band. You know?
Fab Four.
Yeah. Right.
And even Grey Gardens credits four directors. I believe two of them came on as editors originally. So we were inspired by that. I mean, we found, we already had made the decision, but we were gratified to find that others had done it too. And I think a couple of Pennebaker films might have four directors credited too.
So. Yeah, they had Richard Leacock.
Is that his name? Mm-hmm. I think that's right.
And Robert Drew, who probably didn't do anything, but still, you know, as producer, required a director credit. It shouldn't be down on him, but
yeah, none of that here. So we both came on as editors, and over time we kind of all coalesced into one entity in a way. You know, we all took on the lines became blurrier and blurrier, and we all just took on full responsibility for the project and full investment in the project. And 4 years later, we're all still doing whatever tasks need to be done between the four of us.
Describe, though, that what that festival experience was for you guys. Since how many festivals roughly are we talking about?
About 40, that's, or 50, I would say by now, right?
Maybe 40. Yeah.
Over the course of, premiered in April 2013 at Full Frame, and
Full Frame is in
Durham, North Carolina.
Durham. That's right. So that would have been perfect place to have your world premiere. And then, right, is that where you had
It was our world premiere, and we were honored with their audience award and their environmental film award. And so that was a thrilling start to our run.
Yeah. And if I remember correctly from my conversation with Amy and Jeremy, that everybody came out like it was crazy, like everybody came out, right? Because it was local.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah. That was one of our other most dynamic screenings. It was a full house and lots of friends and family of Clark's.
If I can, answer what you want, but do you get feed? I'm just wondering how you guys, there are four of you, and even if there was just one director, it's a big deal to how do you finance running around the country, let alone maybe even different continents to appear at festivals,
right?
Which is always ideal when you've got it. Right, you know, even though you can't always do it.
Yeah, it's really varied from festival to festival. Sometimes they were able to pay for just one or two of us to go, and so we would divvy up those trips. Sometimes they would pay for all four of us. Sometimes they occasionally wouldn't be able to pay for the travel for all four, but we really wanted to be at a certain festival, and so we would take that on ourselves, take the bus, or figure it out.
Yeah.
And lodging was sometimes paid for, and then occasionally, and often, I mean, probably half the time we were getting some sort of fee. I would say about half the time, maybe.
Yeah.
Did you say no much? I mean, were you asked to go to festivals, or were these? Did you apply to all of them? Submit
a mix.
Some festivals reached out to you based on word of mouth and their knowledge about it.
Yes, and then some of them, even the ones who reached out, some said yes and some said no. Ultimately, I mean, we were reached out to early on. Right. By some really high-profile festivals way before we were ready. But we went ahead and submitted anyway. We submitted originally a 3-hour and 45-minute rough cut to Sundance.
Yeah. And they got not recommended.
No. And then once you start submitting, you're kind of on this treadmill where you just keep following all the deadlines. Well, we can't. We had another year to apply to Full Frame.
If you're going
to
do a 3-hour, 45-minute submission, you should add the fifth name at the top of your credits of Frederick Wiseman.
Except it wouldn't have been worthy of his name. That it was pretty bloated, unfortunately.
Yeah. But and also, if you're having your world premiere at Full Frame, for instance, a lot of other programmers are going to go to Full Frame, right? And they're going to see your film, and then they're going to think, "Oh, this is great. Let's get them in our festival."
Right, right. And that happened at several festivals where we would meet True. Programmers from at AFI Docs. We met the programmer from Virginia Film Festival, which we later showed at, and they honored us with an award. It was wonderful. So there were many great strokes of luck, but also many setbacks too. I mean, we did not get into every festival by any means.
Oh no, I understand.
And it was almost random too, which ones, you know, you'd get into some high-profile ones and not into other high-profile ones, and then sometimes lower-profile ones would not be.
Well, if it was always based on quality, maybe it would seem less random, but it's I don't think that's the case.
Right.
I think there are external components that you have no control over or your film has no necessarily influence on.
Right. Yeah, including how many festivals you've shown at. So as we went through that year and a half of...
But for a small, low-budget indie documentary, right, like A Will for the Woods, the festival momentum that you create, right, and the word of mouth and the buzz and the press and all that is really important, right, because you don't have an enormous marketing budget, I'm assuming. You could say.
It has been a big... We've devoted a significant portion of the limited funds that we had to some marketing, but that still doesn't amount to very much in the scheme of things.
Yeah. And to answer your other question, we would ask for screening fees when they could afford it, and it that goes a long way for us. You know, there's a lot of pay the filmmaker sort of talk these days, and it made all the difference. Because we still have some bills to pay, and everything goes towards making the project, you know, complete.
Yeah. True False made some press not long ago for announcing that they were a part of... I think they're just going to start making that a policy of giving screening fee. I don't know what the look of that would be, but
yeah, I don't know what the amount.
It's setting a precedent.
Great that they're making a statement about that and backing it up. And then some of the awards actually came with a significant monetary award too. Full Frame those were very generous awards, $5,000 and $3,000. So that's huge.
In such a changing landscape, there seems to be more festivals than ever, but theatrical is the tricky thing now. Right. And we're in a world where theatricals are really only, the means to an end, rather, in terms of maybe press, certain reviews that you need, or maybe if you want Oscar consideration or something silly like that. It's not silly. It's an enormous thing, but... Or maybe for even Spirit Awards, I don't remember their rules, or Gotham Awards and that type of thing. But, you might need a theatrical in New York.
Yeah, it was considerations like that motivated us to do a week-long theatrical in New York, although we ultimately opted not to do a week-long theatrical in L.A., so disqualified ourselves from Oscar consideration, unfortunately. But
I see.
Still look forward to having an L.A. premiere. It's a city that we haven't yet shown in, so hopefully sometime soon. And but it was totally worthwhile to do the week-long New York run.
Especially because all four of you at the time lived in New York, right?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It was not too long before Amy had finally had to move back. But it was great. We got a lot of great reviews out of it and some more exposure. And it was totally worth it. But it was a big expense and a lot of energy went into that, of course. But it was worth it.
How did the distribution deal work itself through? Did somebody from First Run Features see the film at a festival, or did you? Did you guys reach out to different distributors? And because I could see a number of I can imagine a number of distributors would be interested in, this would be like fall into their library rather well. I can imagine a few different ones.
Yeah, when we started going to festivals, we're all first time filmmakers, and this is our first feature film that we've directed, we kind of all thought, oh, that's what you do at festivals. You go, and then distributors start contacting you. And it was a little bit trickier than that. There's just so many films out there, it's hard to find those right connections and make sure you're noticed, even if you're at a festival, because every film at the festival is pretty good. So, we partnered with Bullfrog Films for community and educational, and First Run for DVD and online. We did our own theatrical, and we have another international one. So a lot of it, I'm trying to piece it together in my head.
I think we reached out to them,
but because of all the festivals, they were, very eager to have a conversation.
Yeah. Again, I know they'd pick up a lot of documentaries.
Yeah.
And it just seemed like a good fit. So you mentioned Bullfrog, is it called? I don't know them, but they're an educational institutional distributor. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense, too. And that is another way to a good source of potentially for financing your return and getting back going. Right? Because it's more lucrative per rental, per purchase, what have you, right?
Yeah, right. And it's also, because it involves public screening rights to libraries. So it's a whole other sort of venue, all various venues. But then we're doing our own theatrical, which sometimes involves, public screenings too. So it's kind of a hodgepodge of things.
Yeah. And the reason I'm asking kind of like more practical questions in terms of exhibition, distribution, all those things, because I think in my conversation with Amy and Jeremy, we focused more also on, just the story, and which happy to talk about. But I just also thought, especially on the cusp of you're doing these extras right now for your DVD and maybe iTunes or what have you, but I think it's an opportunity for a lot of documentary filmmakers to really learn about, because you guys really did have such a big, nice festival run and have so many great sound, from what I hear, good, like really good experiences in screening your film.
Yeah. And I would do it this way again. I mean, it's been, in one way it's been draining because it just keeps going on and on.
Yeah, yeah.
But I really find the sort of staged release more manageable and if you can keep stoking the fire, I think it's a good way of just building awareness over time instead of having to have one big splash all out and then fade away quickly, possibly.
Right.
It's been working out great.
Could do that. Yeah, there's something about the sheer number of films that come out and the machine-like, as you, I think you just described it, evolution of a film's lifespan that just feels a bit mechanical and a bit like conveyor belt, where it's like you're losing the essence of the specialness of the film if it's just like all scripted out and this is the way it goes and then you're moving and the film's gone and it disappears into the great catalog in the sky or in the ground in this case. So are you guys 50, 60 years down the road when we are grappling about what's the term, death, I guess is the
mortality.
Mortality, dealing with mortality, I suppose. But do you have like a solution? Do you have your ideas of how you're going to handle that question?
Well, we're all pretty keen to have green barrels of our own. Hopefully not too soon, but...
Because I always thought, that I would have my ashes. I just thought, I don't know. I don't think it's morbid. I love the idea of my kid, having my ashes just around, But that is not a green way to go, in fact, right? There's chemicals used,
not
correct?
So green. It's greener than conventional burial.
Right.
But there's a lot of energy that goes into burning a body for several hours at very
cremation.
High heat. And there's pollution that comes from it. And... there's also a violence to it we've all come to feel that we're not too drawn to, and also a desire to control a process that is already an intact and more gentle process. It doesn't need any additional inputs of energy. We can remain within the cycle of life.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I think a lot of people in this movement are trying to build up this positive alternative or an option and not saying that the other things are bad. If you have a ritual that means something to you,
right,
that's really important, because a lot of people just don't even have a ritual that they care about. So if you do have a ritual like cremation that means something, I think no one's saying that's a bad thing. But a lot of people go to it because they think it's the environmentally responsible option. But it's not as green as we'd think. So green burial.
No, I've come around. I think I really would probably at this point after seeing the film decide on a green burial myself.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah. I have no desire to be like in a cemetery like that. I mean, that's no disrespect to those, as you just said, who do, where there might be a religious or some sort of cultural significance to that. But for me, it doesn't. I don't like going to cemeteries. I don't have any desire to visit people in cemeteries.
Right.
Most people just... I only go out of pure necessity, and then I'm like happy the moment I can get out of it.
Yeah, I think most people would agree, and it's just kind of the default option. It's not like people love being in a box in a box in a box.
Right, is what we know.
And, yeah,
yeah. But the idea of being in a wood somewhere,
Mm. Preserve.
In a preserve. Protecting it. You know, and then just with, you know, where somebody can visit the woods. They don't have to go right to where it would be. I mean, but just to have like a serenity and a, you know, like a sort of a significant moment would be enough, you know?
Yeah.
And the knowledge that that loved one is literally becoming, living on, literally,
yes.
in that soil and in those plants
yes.
and in the food that the animals
Beautiful.
Eat.
Right.
It's a wonderful thing. Yes. It's like the only, it's a kind of immortality.
Right. The film, I'm not going to even say anything because I think you said it really well, and that the film is called Will for the Woods. It's co-directed by Amy Brown, Jeremy Kaplan, Brian Wilson, and Tony Hale, the latter two we've been talking with today. And if you do want to see the movie, you certainly have lots of options, and you'll have a bit more shortly. But if you're in the New York City area, come out of Friday, November 21st. I think it's at 6:30 doors, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it should start around 7. I think it starts at 7?
Yeah,
yeah,
probably. All right, and we'll have you're going to have a Q&A, and when Ralph Scott, the filmmaker, has been programming this series at RealWorks, where we're going to have the screening, and you two will be there. Is Jeremy coming too?
I think so, yeah. He is, and of course, Amy will be in Australia.
We'll do the Skype thing with Amy.
Yeah, maybe we could.
Well, if it were a FilmWax screening, I won't be there. But
and people can visit our website to yes. find out information about ways to see the film as well, willforthewoods.com.
Right, and you can maybe even at some point soon pre-order the DVD. Well, we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Mm. Request it on Netflix or iTunes, too, would be a great way of, especially... getting us on there, making sure we're on there.
Oh, sure. Right, yeah. Right. You can search Netflix and request... right, and it will come up in the database, and you see, I guess, save it in the queue, and then it'll eventually, enough people do that, they'll buy your film.
I will say I'm not thrilled with the synopsis that they currently have for us, so I'm actually meaning to write to them to I don't think it accurately gives the sense
of
the film.
I would just think they get it from IMDb or someplace.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It's
don't.
Got fragments of material we've been using, but the way the ones they chose are a little bit just one part of the film, so I'm hoping to get that.
So if you're the editor and you're listening of Netflix... First of all, come on to my show, but then fix their synopsis.
And Brian is an editor of all types. He will not stop editing the synopsis. So if you
can
look through every catalog of every film festival, and you'll see that it's slightly tweaked. It's an evolution.
Don't they mostly go into it without a box, right, or whatever it's called?
Well,
we've had so many since we first
made our Without a Box profile. I mean, it's maybe been updated, but I think it's been a while since we've updated our Without a Box. I wouldn't go there.
Yeah,
go to our website, and even that one.
Yeah,
as of today,
because I need it.
We need to
tweak it.
We've just finished it. I think we're really done now, and so we need to now add that to our website because we've been making the
DVD case. You'll want the film, and you'll want the FilmWax Radio endorsement in there too somehow.
Exactly right.
All right, well, guys, thanks a million for meeting up today.
Oh, thank you, Adam.
Yeah,
it's great meeting you both.
You too.
I was a little nervous going into a conversation with a Buddhist monk. Well, you know, wouldn't you be? If you weren't, you know, accustomed to talking, like, you know, what is a little bit, you know, you have to think differently. You don't want to go in and say things that are insensitive or offend. I mean, it's not my nature to do that, but, you know, I don't know. Well, I think it went pretty well. The film is being distributed by Kino Lorber and is going to be starting a theatrical run again Friday, November 21st. It's a very busy day. I know all my guests have something going on Friday, November 21st. So, you know, I know it gives you contract. But you can accomplish on one weekend seeing all these films if you're really committed to it. So it's going to be at the Lincoln Center at the Eleanor Bunnen Monroe Film Center. In fact, I just read that Richard Gere, you know, Richard Gere, he's going to be doing the Q&A with Nikki, who's the subject of the film, on Saturday, November 22nd at the 5:20 screening in the Gilman Theater, which is, I guess, in this film center. But, you know, there's a few rooms in this theater, but the Gilman Theater is where Monk with a Camera will be screening. So I urge you to check out this fascinating documentary called Monk with a Camera. And here's my conversation with photographer and Buddhist monk, Nikki Vreeland.
I was taught
to always have a handkerchief in the pocket of my jacket. My father taught me that. I'm sure that his father taught him.
He had the most impeccable taste. And it was unusual taste, and it was a little bit flamboyant.
He was the boyfriend of the most glamorous women, and everybody loved Nikki.
But somewhere Nikki was not connected to that very glamorous life. He did not buy into it.
I thought I would be a photographer. From the age of 13, had this passion for photography that nothing else really seemed to take me away from.
If somebody wrote a screenplay about the grandson of Deanna Vreeland becoming a Buddhist and saying no to all artifice, all fluffy surface, I think somebody might read it and say, this is too obvious. And yet that's what happened.
This is Fakirappa. Fakirappa is the person from whom we bought the land on which we are building the monastery.
Nikki was very, very stressed. He felt caught in a situation where no one anticipated that the economy was going to tank, and no one anticipated that people who'd made pledges were not going to be able to respect their pledges.
He was very elegant about it, but also fearless of going to people and saying, look, I need help. And it wasn't for him. It was to save these people. He's pretty singular, maybe totally singular in the Tibetan community.
I kept trying to give it up. I kept trying to not have it be part of my life. And interestingly, it was the fact that I continued to take pictures that enabled the monastery to be built. Look here.
And it's a slow exposure, and
now we're going to do another without any smile.
I know you're only here for a short time before you have to return to the monastery, correct? Where is the monastery located?
Where is it?
The monastery is in a Tibetan refugee settlement in the south of India.
Okay, very good.
And the original monastery was established in Tibet in the 10th century and still exists, though it was pretty much destroyed in the 50s and was reestablished after the Cultural Revolution, after, you know, there was the invasion of the Chinese communists starting at the end of through the 1950s, and then in 1959 His Holiness the Dalai Lama and a group of about 100,000 Tibetans fled and reestablished the great Tibetan monasteries in India. And the monastery I belong to didn't have enough monks to really do that. So our monks lived with other monks in another monastery that was reestablished. And then in 1983, there were enough young monks who had joined the monastery or joined that initial group of actually three monks to reestablish ourselves. I joined 2 years later in 85, and we were 12 monks, and we've grown to be over 100 monks.
So the monks are from all over the world, or?
Well, the original three were from Tibet, and the first group of young monks who joined the monastery were the children of refugees in India, so they were Tibetans born in India. And then the next group of new monks who really started coming in the mid-80s were young Tibetans born in Tibet who had made it across the border to India to join the monasteries that had been destroyed in Tibet and to maintain a tradition that had been destroyed in Tibet. And now the borders are pretty much sealed. The Chinese authorities have really
clamped down.
Yeah. And so most of the new monks tend to be from the border areas, border with Tibet, but within India. There's an area in India in the northeast called Arunachal Pradesh, which is culturally Tibetan. And we have monks from there. Then there's Ladakh, which is part of the state of Kashmir, mm-hmm. In northern India. Ladakh is Tibetan culturally. We have Ladakhi monks. And then the state of Himachal Pradesh, where Dharamsala is, where the Dalai Lama lives and where the Tibetan government in exile is situated. There are border areas with Tibet there that are Tibetan culturally. We have monks from there as well.
So fascinating. You mentioned that you became a monk in 1985, and that's when you went to India.
Yes.
Okay. And I'm wondering, well, it's been so many years, 30 years practically, since then, and I'm wondering if you were to reflect back to the Nikki Freeland then, as yourself now. Not a lot of role playing going on here. But if you were to reflect back at that man, what would you make of him? What would you say to him now?
I think it's more what he would say to me.
Okay,
he had a lot more energy than I do at 60. The person who determined to become a monk, and I had that determination about 4 years before becoming a monk. The person who began studying Buddhism 4 years before that, so really when I was in my early 20s, had this enormous enthusiasm and desire to devote himself to Buddhist studies, spiritual practice, to the point where, as I say, after 4 years of studying, I wished to become a monk, devote myself to this path totally. My teacher very skillfully held me back from becoming a monk for 4 years, and then said, okay, maybe now, and told me to request His Holiness the Dalai Lama's advice. And
was the 4 years his way of saying, be sure? Well, this is
definitely
a big decision. This is an awfully big decision to basically disavow, right, for worldly possessions.
And women.
And women.
Definitely. It was to just test my resolve. And I'm very thankful to him for having forced me to really wait. And what's interesting is that those 4 years changed my attitude towards this wish and made it not into something distant, not into something foreign. It made it, over those 4 years, my life transformed, and I was living a monastic life. I was living in a tiny little room in New York City with very, very simple desires, and so that I was ready to make the next step.
You were transitioning already, in other words.
Yes.
In your own.
And that's important.
Frame
becoming
of mind.
A monk should not be a leap. It should be just
you do cold turkey, kids. Right. Don't quit. Don't do it cold turkey, is your advice.
There are those who can do that. I think that to make the next step into a solid one, it should be a little step, a series of little steps. If the next step is a leap, you land in a very unsure way. Your footing is unsure.
Mm-hmm. And so you were kind of living a somewhat ascetic life, in other words, in New York City, which is, I think, to do that, it must have been challenging with all the, I'm not even talking about something extreme. It just seems to me, just living in New York, there's so much to do and so much going on, and there's so much commerce, and it might be difficult to. But maybe there was less emphasis than the 70s and 80s, too.
Oh, I think there was
less possessions and
plenty of emphasis. it demanded really unplugging, and I remember going into retreat in New York, and I was going to spend a few weeks devoted to a sort of spiritual practice, a daily routine. And so for those few weeks, I cut off from the world. And in those days, we had answering machines.
I remember.
And I left the message.
Outgoing message. Yeah.
The outgoing message, this machine will not take messages. If you want me, please write. and if it's urgent, please send a telegram. And that was it. And I did receive one telegram.
You did?
I did receive some letters. But basically, I never put my machine back on the normal message-taking mode. That was it. I had sort of cut off from the world. So it demanded, and it demands today, a certain sort of muscle or discipline to wean oneself from what you're talking about, these sort of attractions of our society, of our world. And I think it's more difficult today. I think you're right.
Sure.
The smartphone has the ability to bring the outside world into wherever we are. There's no escaping it.
Do you own one now? Or?
Sure, I own two. I own one in America, and I own one in India.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure the Dalai Lama has one, too.
No.
Oh, okay.
He doesn't have a telephone.
All right.
Really, it's, you know, as important and as practical as it is, it definitely challenges one's peace of mind.
Well, you've talked about the discipline part and how you evolved, but I have to ask, how was it scary at the same time?
I remember experiencing one moment of what one might call fear. And it was the night that I determined that I wished to become a monk, or that I might become a monk. And this happened, as I said, a few years after having started my studies, when I realized that the value of becoming a monk was there, was that there was an evident logical value to it. And I realized that I had the freedom to do it. And if I put the two together, I should become a monk. That was terrifying. But there was no escaping it. It made sense to me, and it was the evident thing, right thing to do. And I wished to do it because it was the right thing. And all signs, all roads seemed to lead there. And when I acknowledged, when I recognized that, that was scary. I swallowed and
took a deep breath. And some of the press, you know, language that I read, some of the press materials just said that after your mother died, passed away from, she was ill and she died, and that was sort of what kind of inspired you or you know, prompted you to seek meaning. That might be a tidy way of packaging your experience, but I was wondering if there is some reality to that, the way that it was described.
No, actually, I was already a monk when she died. It was the moment that she discovered a cure to her illness. It was the moment when she suddenly felt she had a new lease on life. It was when she thought that everything was okay. Everything wasn't okay, would never be okay for her or for anyone. I had that realization that we are all going to die, and that therefore devoting ourselves to believing in these permanence of our existence and the tangible nature of the things that we think that we possess is an illusion, is ridiculous. It was that made me realize that becoming a monk was the most valuable thing I could do.
And were you able to articulate these things? Were you able to articulate these things to your family, for instance?
No, this was something that I did all by myself. I actually went and visited my mother at this time when she felt that she had found a cure to her illness, and she was just so happy. And it was that I went to my room and digested and came to the realization that I did. I didn't share it with anyone. I didn't share my wish to become a monk with anyone other than my teacher. And it was only 4 years later when I was ready to become a monk, once I had discussed it with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, that I announced it to my family.
To get to the documentary at hand, I guess the film at hand, you were already an up-and-coming photographer. You'd studied and apprenticed under some pretty amazing and famous photographers, right? You Avedon, Richard Avedon, Irving Penn, you were gearing up to be a professional photographer, but you were also ready to leave all that behind. Did you take vows? Is that how it works?
Yes.
At what point your brother gave you a camera? That was much more recently, right? Or was that right? Was that back then?
I had cameras. Lots of cameras.
I bet.
In about 1980, close to the time that I had this desire to become a monk, mm-hmm. Someone broke into my apartment and took all my cameras. So I suddenly had no camera. But I did have the insurance money from those cameras that supported me. I was happy not to have any cameras.
So they did you a favor.
Oh, they did an enormous favor.
Because were you feeling burdened by them almost? Or is it like they were like an albatross? Or
I remember one trip I took through northern India with a big wooden view camera in a big metal box with all the sheet film holders and sheets of film on the roof of a bus, and I was in the bus and I kept thinking how ridiculous it is to have this big thing up there. It just seemed all out of kilter with the life I was leading and the environment I was leading it in. Though the photographs I took with that camera were a series of portraits of Tibetan lamas up in Dharamsala, in the mountains near where His Holiness the Dalai Lama lives, and also a portrait of His Holiness. So I'm very thankful for having had that camera and for having had the training that allowed me to use it. I sort of felt like the operator of a machine. I mean, I was the technician. I would bring this camera in, I would set it up, I would get the light right with the light coming in from a window, and take the photograph. They were very slow exposures because there was very little light. One was a whole minute exposure where the subject could not move at all for a full minute. The photographs would not have had the quality that they do had I been using a little fast digital camera or anything like that.
Right.
So I'm very thankful for the equipment and for the training that I had, but I was the technician. It was these lamas who gave something of themselves. When you work with a large camera in that very slow way, you're not taking images. You are being given images. The person has to participate and has to give to you in some way. But I was very happy not to have any cameras anymore. And then once I became a monk, soon after I became a monk, when I came back here, when my mother died, my brother said to me, "You have to have a camera." And he gave me a camera. And I went back with this camera. And I was terrified.
But you did take back. And that camera that would eventually play a role, right, again, in your life, in the sense that you were able to take photographs of the new monastery or the monastery that required to be, you needed to raise money for, right, to repair the monastery, which you ultimately became the abbot.
So, yes, my brother gave me a camera. At first, I had a very awkward relationship with it.
How so?
I didn't really...
Was it still a film camera?
Yeah. I didn't want anyone to know that I took pictures. I didn't want anyone to... In the monastery, I live among refugees, poor people. And to have a camera and film and to be able to go around shooting photographs would be a luxury. It would not be what anyone else had the freedom to do. A photographer in the monastery would have been called on to photograph all ceremonies, to photograph all dignitaries coming to the monastery, to photograph events. I didn't want to be the official photographer. I had gone to the monastery to study, to practice, and I didn't want that particular job. So I kept my photographic knowledge hidden, and I kept my interest hidden. But every once in a while, I would take my camera out of its trunk. I thought of it as Pandora's box. And I would use it. I would photograph. I'd do
discreetly?
No, I would line up the monks, do a series of portraits. I would... I'm not a sort of discreet... That's not the style.
I was wondering, because you hadn't described how you reconciled becoming a photographer again. You said you were first self-conscious of flaunting any signs of wealth or what have you. You know,
a friend of mine, the widow of the great French photographer Henri Cartier-Bresson, who herself was a wonderful photographer and important photographer, came to the monastery and she asked for my help in a series of photographs she was doing of young incarnate lamas. And we became close, we became friends. And in our conversation, she could see that I had this great love for photography. And she said, you know, you should really be taking pictures. And I said to her, photography is like the piano. You really have to do your scales to produce, if you're going to produce music. And I don't do my scales, and therefore I'm really not able to. And she said, do your scales. Just do your scales. Just take pictures, a few pictures every day. Just keep yourself going that way. And so I took the camera out of the box, kept it in a drawer in my desk, and photographed every day, taking a few pictures and taking photographs of anyone who came into my room. I little exercises to keep me enthusiastic about photography and to keep me sort of doing it, thinking it.
Right.
And it took me over.
You became a monk with a camera.
Yep.
Okay, so this is kind of where the curious part comes in, because, your life is full of curious parts. But all of a sudden, now there's a documentary about you. And part of the story that the documentary Monk with a Camera tells is you come from a family of wealth and celebrity, too, of course, and put that behind you to become a monk. So the documentary is also interested in that. Who came to you with the idea of wanting to tell your story? And what was the conversation? Because they were, I don't know what you make of people telling your story and your past, how not to make it just a vehicle for, an entertaining documentary, but to honor the choices you've made and where you're living and where you're, studying. And do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Because it's an entertainment business in a sense, too. But it's a great story.
Well, when Guido Santi and Tina Mascara, the filmmakers, came to or wrote to me asking if I would want to do this, I said no. And when they gave their reasons, I said it really didn't matter. I mean, I understood that there might be a story, but that I was devoting my life to the spiritual path, and that having it publicized, having a filmmaker made of it would be disruptive to my spiritual evolution, and that that was, of course, what was most important to me. Not selfishly. I mean, one doesn't pursue the spiritual path out of a desire to it shouldn't be selfish.
Isolate?
It should be, well, isolation is important, but the isolation is a means. The end in Buddhism is the attainment of some state of enlightenment where one can be of better and more effective help to others. And that's the most important thing, to work towards that. So there was no, in my mind, there was no question of having permitting a film to be made about me. It would only be a burden. It would only be an obstacle. It would only make my life and this particular path that I was committed to more difficult. So they eventually understood and respected that, and that was the end of the film project. They were coming to New York, and they contacted me saying that they wished to meet, not to make a film, but just to meet. And I announced to my teacher, with whom I was staying at the time, that I was going to meet these people who had asked if they could make a film about me, which I had said no to. And he said, "Why did you say no? You should do it." And I said no, because I really didn't think it was sort of beneficial, and that I felt that it would be an obstacle. And he said, no, it would be important. You should do it. I think that he meant that a film on my life would be of benefit to others, and that it would sort of show, make Buddhism accessible to others, and that I should therefore think of participating in the film in that light. And that, of course, changed everything. I mean, first of all, I was being told to do it, and second of all, I was being shown...
Right, it was out of your hands.
And so yes. I said yes, and so I told the filmmakers that I would be agreeable to doing it, and I'm doing my best to help in any way I can.
How was that experience in the end?
The filmmakers, Guido Santi and Tina Mascara, have been absolutely wonderful, so respectful, so supportive, really, really extraordinary. And they just made sure that their take, that their angle was always correct, was always right. They were totally supportive of my, what you call, my needs, my sensitivities.
Right, especially to those around you, of course, it was probably what you mean.
They've been
and the message, really,
and I feel that the film reflects that beautifully.
Yeah, I could see why you would feel that way. And how did it feel to be on the other side of the camera? I guess is
for me.
Yeah.
Well, I must admit that I'm always a little self-conscious when the lens is aimed at me, and I can do it. But I always realized that I was not totally natural. I would sort of take a deep breath when it was finished and be able to relax, which I never felt I could when the camera was at me. So, I mean, even here in this interview,
sure.
I feel
yes.
on.
Right. No, I understand that phenomenon. And sometimes I don't even, as I think we did here, I just sort of started without kind of saying go, because I try to do as much as I can to eliminate that, you know, formality, which creates a kind of, you know, attention, you know, when you're saying we're starting, you know. So I do my best to kind of keep it, you know, overall how I shoot my film. I kind of try to keep it conversational. But
Is there a camera someplace?
I was using a metaphor. I mean, my film. Yeah. Oh, and I wonder if it wasn't so intrusive as you initially thought, in which, but I'm wondering, did it also on the other side of it? Maybe did it help in your evolution at all? Because when they come to you for the, you know, the Hollywood version, which is inevitable, you do know that.
So did it help? You know, one has to take any challenge one has as an opportunity to work on oneself. And definitely when you have a film made about yourself, your ego gets tickled, and then you have to wrestle with that. You have to sort of bring yourself back to reality, and the opportunity to do that should be viewed as a constructive one. So they've provided me with plenty of those.
That's a great answer. Well, the documentary is called Monk with a Camera, The Life and Journey of Nicholas Vreeland. Maybe I should have been calling you Nicholas all this time. And it's directed by Guido Santi and Tina Mascara. And it is being distributed by Kina Lorber. And I thank you very much for sitting and making time for this on your schedule. And you're heading back to India in a couple of days, it sounds like.
Yep.
You must be looking forward to that. And
very much so, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It'll be monsoon. That's a cool, rainy time, but nice time to be there.
Well, it was a pleasure meeting you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Well, thank you, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that episode, number 256 of FilmWax Radio. It's just the greatest thing in the world to know you have listeners when you work as hard as I do on this podcast. I listen to a lot of podcasts myself, and I have a great amount of respect for the other producers and hosts of the podcast. So, you know, I guess all I would expect or request you do is to just continue to spread the word and act as an ambassador for me, for the podcast, FilmWax Radio, and it's, you know, it's tremendously appreciated. If you are a subscriber, thank you. If you are not, what's the problem? You know, you can just subscribe. If you have a smartphone, it'll just pop on your phone every time I post a new show without even you having to do anything. If I ask you to do anything, it's not to give any money. What I'm asking you to do is, you know, just go to iTunes and give a star rating. Maybe say a few words about your thoughts on the podcast. If you go to iTunes and you search FilmWax or FilmWax Radio, you will have the ability to just type in your review of the podcast and to leave a star rating. I think it gives up to 5 stars. 1 is you don't like it, and 5 is you really like it. So, you know, I'll let you decide where in the 4 or 5 star area you want to, you know, select. I kid, of course. If you don't like the show, don't ignore what I'm saying. And if you've made it this far into the podcast, I'm guessing you kind of like it. But if you have constructive criticism, by all means, please send it through. You can also reach me at on Facebook under my name, Adam Chartoff. It's Schartoff. You can go to the Facebook page there. You can go to the FilmWax Radio Facebook page. And you can leave a comment there. You can tweet us at FilmWax Radio. There's lots of ways to reach me. You can even email me at adam@filmwax.com. And I do get back. I get emails. Someone recently just shot me a note asking me to watch his wife's documentary. I watched it. It was darn good. About busking, and I really enjoyed it. So if you're listening, thank you for sending that, guys. I really appreciated it. It was a really good documentary. Anything else coming up? There's more news coming, but I can't talk about it on this episode yet. I have to wait to be a little more patient. I just want to say, if you're listening this deep into the show, that I have some news to share, hopefully on the next episode or two. One of the next couple of episodes, I think I'm going to share some news about what I'm going to be doing. Something new. And I'm very excited about it. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, do please go check out any of these 3 films. Again, there are Monk with a Camera, A Will for the Woods, or Little White Lie. They're also so entertaining, and so, you know, it's really, they're satisfying. That's what it is. Next on the podcast is very special, probably if you're a big film buff, if you're really into indie films, you've probably already heard of this film called A Girl Who Walks Home Alone at Night. Well, it premiered at Sundance. Then it went to New Directors, New Films. It was at Rooftop Films. It's just played in tons and tons of places. Well, finally, it's having a theatrical as well. Well, it's such a great film, and I'm very excited that I will be having on the director of this film, A Girl Who Walks Home Alone at Night, Anna Lily Amirpour, and her lead actress, Sheila Vand, and they will both be on on the next episode of the podcast. So we'll look forward to that. And actor Jason Ritter as well, who is in a new film called Always Woodstock, and so much more. Here's where I guess I sign off and say thank you for listening, everybody. This is your host, Adam Shartoff. The name of the show is Film Wax Radio. We're presented by Rooftop Films. Until next time, thanks so much.